The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Democrats play the foreign policy card on Trump, looking for a lift by battering Trump on his Syrian move.
This president, and I agree with Bernie, is the most corrupt president in modern history.
Seth Frantzman, Jerusalem Post op-ed editor, is concerned.
This is a very big piece of landscape that the United States, with just 1,000 soldiers and about 100,000 Kurds that had been trained.
A U.S. military expert has a different perspective. Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis.
Given the nature of the region, there will be death and devastation.
And a pollster sizes up the Democratic field after Tuesday's debate.
We're still talking about Hunter Biden in a couple of weeks. You know, Biden's campaign has real issues.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Good to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. Things are starting to shake out within the Democratic presidential field. 12 candidates debated in my home state of Ohio on Tuesday night. They posed as foreign policy experts, hammering away on Trump.
What has happened in Syria is yet again Donald Trump selling folks out. And in this case, he sold out the Kurds.
Whatever happened in the president's meeting with Erdogan, the military move from Turkey was clearly beyond anything the administration expected. And now the complex matters of U.S. troops in northern Syria has several angles. My Salem colleague Dan Proft and co-anchor Amy Jacobson of 560 The Answer in Chicago sought perspective from Seth Frantzman, Middle East analyst at the Jerusalem Post.
So Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, mainly Biden, but we'll throw Kamala Harris in there as well. They write to be as outraged as they were last night on that debate stage.
Well, I mean, I think that the talking points they had are right in a sense. I mean, there's a bit of grandstanding because I don't think once you've let the kind of horse out of the corral and you've decided to leave a place and all these other groups are rushing in, I actually don't see them, if they were in charge, actually necessarily going in there and doing much. I think there are certainly questions to be asked about what happened on October 6th and why the decision in this case wasn't, you know, laid out 6 months ago, in which the U.S. could, you know, work with Turkey and or talk to the Assad regime or even and tell the Kurds and be straight with them, listen, we fought together, but at some point, you know, the U.S. has decided to leave. So I think it would have been better had this whole thing been managed a lot better, being saying, okay, well, we'll ride back in and, yeah, and we'll defend the Kurds.
Yeah, but things have changed since we've pulled out. And who are the Kurds turning to for help?
They said, you know, if we have to choose between being slaughtered and genocide and have to choose between that and the Assad regime, which is the devil that we know in terms of the former regime, so we'll sign some sort of a deal with them which will create some sort of a buffer in which the airstrikes will stop and the Turkish invasion will stop. So that's kind of the hard place that they were put in. We have to remember this is a really big area. I think the area in eastern Syria is almost the size of the Kingdom of Jordan. It's about the size of West Virginia or something like that, or New Jersey. So, you know, this is a very big piece of landscape that the United States, with just 1,000 soldiers and about 100,000 Kurds that had been trained, Kurds and Arabs, was actually able to maintain a lot of influence over.
I certainly agree with you about how this could have been managed better and then communicated better when the decision was made. There's no question about that in my mind. But in terms of the explanation that has been given over the last several days by Secretary of Defense Esper as well as Senator Rand Paul, that one of the issues that changed the circumstances that led to this decision is Erdogan saying, we're coming in whether your troops are staying or not. And the concern that, of course, 15,000 Kurdish or something on that order, Kurdish troops were going to easily overrun 50 to 100 American special forces.
Right, but I mean, I don't know. I look back to American history. I certainly think that over the last 30 years, you know, when it was George W. Bush or George H.W. Bush or even back to Ronald Reagan, I think in the end of the day, there's a lot of countries that not so long ago would never dare to lay a finger on the U.S. Special Forces. So the fact that Turkey, which is ostensibly a quote-unquote NATO ally, was willing to threaten the United States, I don't think that our allies should ever be threatening us. So, you know, these are Kurdish fighters and also Arabs that signed on and trained with the U.S. and helped to defeat ISIS. So I think if we're going to ask a guy to help us fight ISIS and we're going to train him and give him a rifle and we're going to fight side by side in the trench with him, then when someone else comes along and says, okay, tomorrow I'm going to bomb him, the United States, as a great power, should be able to say, well, no, that's not going to happen. So we need to find a way that other countries, whether it's Turkey or Iran, with Iran there, are not able to put us in this vice of saying that, well, if you don't do this, there's going to be war. I think maybe the United States needs to have an internal conversation about whether how we deal with that and whether or not we end up, therefore, you know, saying that these countries are countries we can deal with or be allies with.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's fair. But here's the thing, and I'm not defending this policy or this history. I'm just describing it. You know, these alliances of convenience where we hopscotch around depending on the geopolitics and the political expedient desires of the moment. I mean, Rand Paul, again, made this point, you know, that why we'll never have a vote in the Senate to authorize the use of force is because we don't know who to declare war on. The Syrian Defense Forces were our allies for 7 years. Turkey's a NATO ally. Obviously, the Kurds. So it's real complicated by the complicated choices that have been made by American presidents and presidential administrations over the years. And we see this play out routinely, in particular in the Middle East, but not limited there, Latin America and Central America as well. But, you know, you could use the classic case of Saddam Hussein being a former ally until he wasn't in the Iraq-Iran war. So it seems like we play this out and it's not so particular to this administration.
So I think, you know, it's about explaining what are we doing, why are we doing it, and when we get into these conflicts, deciding exactly what the U.S. is doing and explaining that to ourselves. And I think, you know, also being transparent and clear with people that we're working with and saying, okay, listen, in 6 months or a year, we're going to leave.
My Salem colleague, Sam Malone, sitting in for Mike Gallagher, sought answers from Lieutenant Colonel Robert McGinnis, now with Human Events.
Obviously, the world is focused on what's going on. Syrian forces, U.S. forces heading out the door. Kurds look like they're being shot and killed along the roadside. ISIS members may have all slid out of jail. Russians involved. Lieutenant Colonel Sir, keeping an eye on the events there in the Middle East. What's going on?
Yeah, the Russians apparently have moved into northeast Syria, taking over one of the towns, occupying some facilities, positions that we vacated here recently. You know, it's a mixed bag. We've seen this going on off and on among the tribal groups, the ethnic groups, the religious groups for thousands of years, Sam. Unfortunately, you know, given the nature of the region, there will be death and devastation. The civil war that's been racking Syria for some time, of course, invited the Iranians and the Russians in. And frankly, the Turks have been sitting back waiting for this opportunity. The Turkish position, Erdogan, who's not a friend of mine and certainly not a friend of the U.S. in my estimation, although he is a NATO ally, has been absorbing millions and millions of war refugees from Syria into his country. And he's also having to put up with his own internal issues with the PKK being one of their domestic terrorist organizations, which is Kurdish-based and aligned with the Kurds that we've been working with for years as well. So the volatile mix there, it's not necessarily going to improve anytime soon, but I think that I happen to have been on the record of supporting the president's decision for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is because we face some very existential threats long-term against the likes of China and Russia, and we better wake up to it or we're going to be in a very, very bad situation.
Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis at the Pentagon, author of books like Alliance of Evil, The Deeper State, Progressive Evil, a lot of books out there. What do you take about, I guess it was 2 days ago, I guess Turkey started shelling U.S. outposts, very obvious, very visible U.S. outposts. And it's like they were putting bombs on both sides, not necessarily to hit, but kind of bracket them in, kind of scare or worry our U.S. Army Special Forces, sir. What's your take on that?
Well, you can take it from several ways, Sam. As I've graduated the Artillery Advanced Course at Fort Sill many years ago, and I fired a lot of artillery and mortars over the years, mistakes are made. Perhaps the professional Turkish artillery corps made a mistake. Or you can take it cynically and say, no, they purposely targeted that because they saw that we were the harbinger that kept them at bay for years and years. Or they could say that when the U.S. vacated the Kurdish terrorists, as they consider them, moved in and occupied those positions. So it can be taken in a variety of ways. I wouldn't want to be on the ground primarily because it's a confusing battlefield with so many different entities. You know, certainly the Iranians are taking advantage of it, and the Russians have solidified their relocation into that area. And now that the Turks are feeling their oats, they're going to do what they believe is necessary. Very, very volatile situation.
It's volatile, the capital V. Lieutenant Colonel Bob McGinnis joining us, author, because you had mentioned Russia patrolling between the Turks and the Syrians, right, with the U.S. getting out. They're also on the edge where Israel is, and when Israel puts their jets in the air, the Russians are very close. So it's like two sets of tripwires in that neck of the woods. You know, one small match, big fire.
Well, it is. And, of course, it's interesting that Russia, Vladimir Putin, and the government in Jerusalem, Tel Aviv, do get along. And they try to coordinate directly when they're flights are going into the same areas. We've made some mistakes. They've made some mistakes. You know, it's interesting that although the Israelis don't claim this, a lot of other people attribute, you know, significant strikes all over the northern Iraq to the Israelis, certainly all over Syria and in Lebanon. The Israelis are going to defend their interests against the Iranian tyrants who have every indication from the likes of their Quds Force and the IRGC who have threatened the annihilation of Israel. And, of course, their tepid, some people say more aggressive, nuclear program, which is continuing, as I understand, behind the scenes. So there are a host of issues here that Israel's concerned about. I don't think that our exit from that small part of Syria, given our footprint in Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and even in Incirlik, Turkey, is that significant at this point.
Coming up.
We're still talking about Hunter Biden in a couple of weeks. You know, Biden's campaign has real issues.
Democratic candidates move into alignment. Next on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Stay with us. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Although the group has thinned out, 12 Democratic presidential candidates have hung on to the debates that continued in Ohio on Tuesday night. There was unanimity on the impeach Trump question.
The impeachment must go forward.
We have to impeach this president.
It is absolutely imperative to go forward with impeachment.
And Elizabeth Warren attracted more than normal attention from her peers. Curious to see whether Joe Biden had lost his lead to Warren after his son Hunter's activities in the Ukraine were spotlighted, I spoke with Alex Conant of Firehouse Strategies. He gave me a quick answer.
You were in the poll. You were in the field October 8th through 10. Who's winning the Democratic primary before we turn to impeachment?
Simple answer is Elizabeth Warren's winning it right now. And I think anyone who watched some of the debate last night or saw any of the coverage is pretty apparent that all the other candidates think she's winning as well. We have her leading in Iowa and New Hampshire, which, of course, are the first two states. Joe Biden was winning earlier this summer. He has slipped quite a bit, although he's still winning in South Carolina, I think, thanks largely to the large black voter population there where he still continues to do well. But I think Warren, as of today, is definitely the front runner in the Democratic primary.
Is anyone in third place who is a pop? I mean, who's in fourth place? Bernie might be in third place. He's not plausible anymore after the heart attack. Who's plausibly positioned to move in to challenge Warren?
And so interestingly enough, we saw Pete Buttigieg starting to make a move. He's now, in our poll, doing very well in Iowa. He's in a solid third place of 17%. That's a big jump from where he was just 3 months ago. That's largely come as Sanders, as you said, has really just collapsed. He's down into single digits in Iowa. He still does a little bit better in New Hampshire, which, of course, is his neighboring state there in Vermont. But Buttigieg is someone to keep an eye on. I think if you watched the debate last night, Buttigieg was also somebody who started to draw some fire from some of the other candidates. I think other candidates are seeing our polling, and they probably have their own polling that is similar to ours that says, you know, Buttigieg is on the rise and somebody that I think everyone should keep an eye on, especially if, Hugh, to your point, if Biden continues to stumble. If we're still, we went into the field right before the Hunter Biden news broke, so we weren't able to pull up this time. If it's still in the news in the next time we do our survey, which will be in a couple of weeks, we'll definitely ask about it. But I can tell you right now, if we're still talking about Hunter Biden in a couple of weeks, Biden's campaign has real issues.
I think it's dead anyway. And I thought Buttigieg did very well last night, and Amy Klobuchar. I just don't know if they have enough time, space, and energy to get back in the ring with Elizabeth Warren. Talk to me about impeachment. The Democrats must be reading poll numbers that their base wants them to pound the drum, even though at large, the idea is growing, I think, very quickly that this is a kangaroo court. But what does your polling show about impeachment?
In this poll, Democratic primary voters now overwhelmingly want to impeach Trump. Something like 4 in 5 think he needs to be impeached, and that was reflected on the debate stage last night, where I think every candidate agreed that he should be impeached and removed from office. We also asked you, we were trying to test intensity. Remember over the summer, Nancy Pelosi said she didn't want to see him impeached, she wanted to see him in jail. So we asked Democratic voters, do you think that Donald Trump should be imprisoned? And over half in all three of the early primary states, Iowa, New Hampshire, and South Carolina, over half the Democratic primary voters said yes, Donald Trump should be imprisoned, which I think just shows, not only they don't think he should be in the Oval Office, they think he should be in jail. And I mean, it's really out of sync with, I think, where the rest of the country is at. But it shows you why Democrats in Congress are so hell-bent to pursue these impeachment allegations, because that's what their Democratic voters are demanding.
And you do early states, and the early states are older and whiter than the other states. I'm not sure impeachment matters to the African-American base. Have you broken out the crosstabs in South Carolina where there's a decent number of, there's a large, actually, African-American population of primary voters?
Yeah, there's less support in South Carolina, for sure. I think that's in part because you do have those African-American voters. It's also why Joe Biden is doing disproportionately well in South Carolina.
Everyone who follows media and politics knows that the atmosphere is heavy, growing even heavier with machinations from Democrats hungry for impeachment. It's well over a year before the election. The campaigns are in full tilt, and the noise is already deafening. And the enmity towards President Trump is out of control. What's fueling all of this? Is it the media? James O'Keefe, whose Project Veritas you may remember from earlier sting operation videos, is now out with evidence the elite media has something of a vendetta against Trump. O'Keefe was a guest of my colleague Sebastian Gorka.
This is a 30-second audio cut from the latest video. This is CNN's Jeff Zucker being recorded on the morning editorial call at CNN.
I think what's going on in America now is really fundamentally the result of years of fake news, conspiracy nonsense from Fox News.
He was calling Fox News fake news and a propaganda machine. And with what I saw, I'm like, that's pretty much what CNN was. Like, it's just pumping out propaganda.
The fake conspiracy nonsense that Fox has spread for years is now deeply embedded in American society.
So the problem is Fox News, and Jeff Zucker is giving direction to attack the so-called fake news of Fox News. James, tell us more about how you got this audio and the rest of what America can expect from your revelations.
Well, this is a pretty extraordinary series of events because it's both hidden camera muckraking into a news network, which you don't really see every day, and then it's also the guy who did it is not one of my own undercover people infiltrating. This is one of their own staff who turned on them, and this staff member is not a Republican. He is a self-identified Democrat and Bernie Sanders voter.
Wow.
He's disillusioned by the network. Every one of these staffers is talking about how Jeff Zucker calls the shots, and Jeff Zucker has made the decision to vendetta against Trump, according to one of the employees, said that there's a vendetta against Trump. It's the network has, quote, sold themselves to the devil. It's the Trump network. They created the monster. And that Jeff Zucker has turned it into a game show. On these meetings, you can actually hear Zucker just say, we got to pursue impeachment. We can't do anything else. We can't do any other news. He even says, I don't care about anything else. I just want to pursue impeachment. So it's pretty extraordinary when you have the president of the network on tape admitting to this. Zucker was very upset on the call and talked about Project Veritas and talked about these tapes and told people not to talk about them. So that we're inside their heads, and we're exposing the truth with this brave insider. So in these tapes, you could see it over and over again. People talking about how, I'm going to quote some folks here, that Jeff Zucker blatantly hates Trump and he runs CNN. So he kind of rolls with an iron fist and, quote, Jeff Zucker tells us what to do. You get on this 9 a.m. call and the big boss Zucker tells us what to do, and we got to make profits. So Zucker is saying this week they had a game show to decide what dates there. It's going to be this debate. So he takes a huge role in crafting the news with a political angle, and this is the most trusted name in news. For some reason, this is played in airports, this station,
yes.
And everyone trusts it, but now you get to see what the emperor has no clothes and what they really think.
Well, you've done it again, James. Donald Trump and James O'Keefe are living inside the heads of Jeff Zucker.
I just hope CNN does sue me for, I don't know what they'd sue me for, but I hope they do sue me so that we can litigate this and fight for the truth.
Listen to the complete interviews with Alex Conant and James O'Keefe at townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Government does not create religious liberty. It is granted by God the Creator. It is merely respected and is to be protected and honored by government.
The secular threat defined. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. U.S. Attorney General William Barr has served in the current role for less than a year, but he's a veteran. This is his second tour of duty in that office, having served as Attorney General during President George H.W. Bush's presidency. General Barr came back at a challenging time as the nation, including the FBI and the DOJ, was in turmoil over the Russian collusion matter. Many believe he is absolutely the right man for such a time in our republic. Barr's recent address on religious liberty at Notre Dame Law School caught the attention of my friend Albert Mohler, my longtime colleague on Salem's editorial board. Here's Mohler from his briefing program.
As you're looking at Attorney General Barr, it's interesting to note the controversy that emerged from a speech he gave on Friday at the University of Notre Dame. He spoke to the law school and to the D. Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture there at the University of Notre Dame. And what he said has set the secular left absolutely into consternation. The Attorney General of the United States spoke openly of the defense of religious liberty, but he also spoke of the subversion, not only of religious liberty, but of the moral order under a secularist regime. The Attorney General spoke with unusual clarity about matters on which government officials are often profoundly and intentionally unclear. The Attorney General spoke as himself a Catholic. He spoke at a Catholic institution. There should be no surprise that what he said would resonate with Catholic teaching. But what we need to note is that more than anything else, he has infuriated the left, largely, we should note, if not entirely, by telling the truth. The Attorney General, in a way, again, uncommon in recent American history, sought to situate religious liberty, first of all, as America's first liberty and as a primary understanding of how the founders of this nation understood tyranny eventually to be checked and liberty to be preserved. The big question, as the Attorney General indicated, was how Americans would live in such a way that without an oppressive government, they would not use liberty for license to destroy the very society that the founders were establishing. The fact is that the founders and the framers of our constitutional order were themselves the products of an explicitly Christian culture, even if they were not believing Christians themselves. They understood the binding authority of revealed religion based upon theism and the understanding of the Creator, who would also be the judge. The Attorney General cited James Madison in a 1785 pamphlet entitled Memorial and Remonstrance Against Religious Assessments, who described religious liberty as a right towards men, but a duty towards the Creator. And, as the Attorney General cited, duty precedent both in order of time and degree of obligation to the claims of civil society. End quote. There you have a profoundly important point. Government does not create religious liberty. It is granted by God the Creator. It is merely respected and is to be protected and honored by government. The Attorney General spoke of the 21st century, saying we face an entirely different kind of challenge after having referenced communism and fascism. He went on to say, and I quote, the challenge we face is precisely what the founding fathers foresaw would be our supreme test as a free society. He continued, quote, they never thought the main danger to the republic came from external foes. The central question was whether, over the long haul, we could handle freedom. The question, he said, was whether the citizens in such a free society could maintain the moral discipline and virtue necessary for the survival of free institutions. By and large, he said, the founding generation's view of human nature was drawn from the classical Christian tradition. His next sentence is also very important, quote, those practical statesmen understood that individuals, while having the potential for great good, also had the capacity for great evil, end quote. Again, a profoundly Christian point. It's a Pauline point, speaking of the Apostle Paul. It is an Augustinian point, speaking of one of the great patristic theologians of the early church. It's a truth foundational to the American founding and to our constitutional system of government producing a republic. It understands that human beings are capable of good, but also capable of great evil. The good is therefore to be encouraged. The evil is to be restrained. But then the Attorney General went on to say, quote, but if you rely on the coercive power of government to impose restraints, this will inevitably lead to a government that is too controlling and you will end up with no liberty, just tyranny, end quote. That is something that intelligent Christians need to think about very soberly. We are looking at the reality that if we count on government to provide all of those moral restraints, then you can count on the fact that the government will restrain. It will use its power to restrain in such a way that it eventually restrains all the way to oppression. If you count upon the state to provide your moral code, then the state will be quite willing to do just that. But it will be to the state's advantage.
Coming up, resistance at all costs.
The haters are something different. They have rejected this presidency before the president even took office and have been willing to take whatever means they deem necessary to get rid of him. That's a very distinct group of people.
Kimberly Strassel, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. During the time of the investigation of President Trump, beginning shortly after he won the election, perhaps no journalist reported it more carefully and doggedly than Kimberly Strassel. The Wall Street Journal editorial board member became a must-read in the fight for the soul of our nation. She's now out with a book telling the tale. The title, Resistance at All Costs. Here she is with my colleague, Dennis Prager.
When you were writing the book, were you writing, in effect, putting into a book what you already more or less knew? with all your research to write your columns and editorials to Wall Street Journal, or did new stuff come to you?
So there's new things in the book, but I think the important part of the book is that it attempts to wrap together and put into context the last 3 years. And when I started it, it was just because I'd spent all this time writing about the Russia collusion mess. And it just struck me that for 3 years, I'd been listening to the mainstream media and the left inform me that Donald Trump was breaking all these institutions, destroying democracy, undermining all of our most cherished things. And yet at the same time, I was doing all this reporting, which showed that, in fact, it was Jim Comey and Andrew McCabe and a dossier from an opposition research firm and activist groups on the left that were, in fact, breaking all the rules in their ambition to get rid of a sitting president or a candidate at the time. And the more I looked around, the more I realized that that pretty much summed up that rule breaking. A whole bunch of things that we were seeing coming from the resistance to Donald Trump, whether they were breaking our Senate confirmation process during the Kavanaugh hearing, whether they are breaking the incredible power of the impeachment tool by using it for partisan purposes, whether they are breaking trust in the bureaucracy or trust in the FBI by abusing their powers. There's some real damage happening here, and it's long and it's lasting, and it's going to outlast Donald Trump by a long shot.
One big macro question. You use the term in your subtitle of your book, Trump Haters. This hatred comes from where?
Well, first of all, I'm so glad you point that out, because I made a conscious decision to use that word and not use the word. When the publishers first came to me, they had the word critics.
And I, that's a riot.
So I rejected that because, you know, critics. I'm a critic of Donald Trump.
Of course,
Trump,
exactly.
You are too. Any thinking person, it's their obligation to look at a presidency and judge those things that are good and those things that are bad. The haters are something different. They have rejected this presidency before the president even took office and have been willing to take whatever means they deem necessary to get rid of him. That's a very distinct group of people that I put in that category. And what I mean, and how did they get this way? Look, first of all, part of it, you know this, I think every Republican president gets a harder time from the media and, you know, obviously than others do. There's a certain disdain there for conservative ideas, all right? I think a huge amount of this comes from the fury of losing the 2016 election, and don't underestimate that. The left was banking on Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton extending Barack Obama's legacy of taking over the Supreme Court for the first time. They had grand ambitions, and they were furious at the loss. But I think part of it is just they can't stand Donald Trump's brand of politics, and there's a contempt for, I think what he's exposed is a contempt that a lot of the elites just have for average Americans who lean a little right and support these policies.
So the hatred, it's a very complex question, and I agree with everything you said. But so let us say, God forbid, the president died just peacefully in his sleep, and Mike Pence becomes president. Would there be less hatred?
I don't know if there'd be less. I think there would be marginally less hatred, put it that way. And I think that maybe the tactics wouldn't be quite so insane. But what does worry me is that now that the left and the media have got a taste for this, for just doing whatever they want and breaking all the rules and barriers that they want, I make this point in the book a lot, it's very hard to put these genies back into the bottle.
Let's talk about this genie of the press. What's happened?
Well, what happened with the press? Look, again, Q and I have known the press has always leaned left, and there's always been a bias there. But I've always, until the last few years, felt that it was sort of almost a passive bias in that I think the problem with the press is that a whole bunch of our writers, they all socialize with each other. They all think the same way. It's a bubble, right? There's a lack of diversity of viewpoint in newsrooms. And so sometimes they didn't even realize the degree to which they are biased or lean left. What we've seen in the last 3 years, and I've been in journalism for 25 years, is the active decision by the press corps to join one side of a partisan war and then to get rid of all of their standards. Mike Pence, the vice president, was in charge of the transition team. An enormous number of constitutional conservatives got put into the key posts. This has been a very rule-bound administration. I mean, look, it's an administration. If you're a dictator, you don't go and get rid of tons of regulations and make the power of the federal government smaller.
That's a great point. Yes.
You know, you don't appoint textualist judges to the court that are going to follow the law. So, but if they were being honest about this, these were the words they would have used about Barack Obama, because the contrast is quite stunning. This was a guy, you know, pen and phone. Whenever he couldn't get Congress to pass legislation he wanted, he told his agencies to just make it up, and he ruled by executive fiat. When Obamacare wasn't working, they just unilaterally changed the law. They politicized the Department of Justice and used it for political purposes, like going after the financial sector over things, you know, just to make political points. These are things that should be very concerning. If the press had been honest, they would have talked about that administration's actions. And I keep reminding my friends on the left that, for instance, those engaged in this impeachment drama at the moment. Okay, let's say that Donald Trump loses next year, and let's say Republicans win the House and the Senate. Do we immediately commence impeachment proceedings against Elizabeth Warren? Is this how we're going to settle differences these days? That's something, again, that's the breaking part of America, and something we all need to think very hard about.
To hear Dennis' complete conversation with Kimberly Strassel, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
John Newton didn't say, "Amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like you."
Dr. Everett Piper. In the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Dr. Everett Piper served as president of Oklahoma Wesleyan University from 2002 to 2019 before retiring last May. He became well known when he advised his students during the Safe Spaces debate at universities that there would be none of these safe spaces at Oklahoma Wesleyan. He was one of the early leaders to boldly and publicly push back and to push for the First Amendment. He followed on the Safe Spaces address with a book. This is not a daycare center. This is a university. Dr. Piper was a guest of my Salem colleague and fellow Buckeye Bob France, who was sitting in for Dennis Prager.
What a phenomenal idea. Looking at one's self and what I, or we, in your perspective, can do on our own to try to make changes that we deem necessary, that will help the country, that will help the world, rather than looking elsewhere and saying, you do it.
Well, my article is about Jordan Peterson. He's in Australia on a TV show there, and there was a panel discussion afterwards and questions from the audience. A millennial-aged woman asked him a critical question. Basically, she was criticizing him for emphasizing personal responsibility rather than corporate social justice. His response was to suggest that if we look at our own inadequacies and our own flaws first and get our own lives in order, it's only at that point in time that we can take a responsible role in the world. Great idea, huh? Take a look at yourself first. Get your own house in order before you start criticizing everybody else, is essentially what he said. And here's my summary. If you don't have your act together, stop deflecting. Stop trying to make yourself look good by blaming others. Show some respect and take responsibility. Change yourself before you try to change everybody else. Lose weight before you complain about the world being fat. Stop overeating before you blame overconsumption for climate change. Stop using planes, trains, and automobiles before you condemn the world for its use of fossil fuels. Start paying more taxes before you try to increase mine. Remove the lock from your front door before you presume to lecture others about open borders. And if sanctuary cities are so good, prove it. Start with your own home and fill it with illegal immigrants before preaching to the rest of us about how walls are sinful. Shouting duplicitous nonsense about tolerance and love when at the same time you are screaming, I can't tolerate your intolerance and I hate hateful people, is not a winning argument. But basically I say this, revival always begins with repentance. It never starts with rebuke. John Newton didn't say, amazing grace, how sweet the sound that saved a wretch like you.
You talk about this from a scriptural standpoint as well, right?
I do. I conclude with Jesus' admonition that, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and you pay no attention to the plank that's in your own? Jesus calls those types of people hypocrites. And the progressive left would do well to learn that lesson.
Thanks for joining us for this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.